Good afternoon. My name is Julie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Impact of Expanding Privacy and Security of Personal Health Information conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Tom Green, Senior Director of Sales and Marketing, Premier Insurance Management Services. Sir, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Julie. Good afternoon from Charlotte, and welcome to Premier's Advisor Live series. As Julie mentioned, I am Tom Green. I'm Senior Director of Sales and Marketing for Premier Insurance Management Services, and we are a wholly owned subsidiary of Premier, Inc. I'll be your host for today. Just a few quick announcements before I introduce our speakers. This teleconference is being recorded and will be posted to the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com within 24 hours. Following today's presentations, the operator will instruct you how to ask questions. You may also submit them through the chat feature on your screen. Look for a follow-up email shortly after the call with information on how to access today's materials. It will also include a link to a brief survey about the program. I want to thank you in advance for your comments and recommendations. Now I'd like to start the program by introducing you to today's speakers. First up is Mark Zwillinger, a partner with Sonnenschein, Neff, and Rosenthal Law Firm. Mark chairs the firm's Internet Communications and Data Protection Group, where he provides advice and counsel on issues related to the increasingly complex laws governing Internet practices, communications, and data protection laws. Our final speaker is Rebecca Fayed, who is the leading expert on HIPAA privacy and security issues for Sonnenschein, Neff, and Rosenthal. We are delighted they can join us to provide our members with an overview of the HITECH Act. For those of you that perhaps were on previous calls overviewing the red flag rules, you will have recognized Mark as our speaker in that presentation. Mark and Rebecca's firm's provides a no-cost risk management partnership with a cyber liability solution we offer to Premier members through Access Pro Insurance Company. But additionally, Sonnenschein assists hospitals establish written identity theft programs as required under the recently implemented red flag rules and can also assist in conducting data privacy security audits. This fee-for-service is available to Premier members for a discount. And if you are interested, please contact me after today's presentation for more details. So now let's get to today's presentation. Mark, I turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. So I put up the agenda slide to begin with to give you all a roadmap of where we're going. The most important things, as we previewed in the advance announcement, that we want to cover is to talk about the HITECH Act's breach notification requirements. This is the first federal data breach law that exists in the, you know, in the information security space, and we've been advising clients for about 7 years now on how to comply with various breach notification requirements at the state level. Those didn't include medical record information before, and now they do. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the FTC regulations for vendors of personal health records and their breach notification requirements and how they're very similar. We're going to talk about ways to avoid the HITECH Act breach notification requirements, and that's specifically by securing the personal health information that you may have in your possession. And then I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca, who's going to walk through a variety of additional changes that the HITECH Act implemented to the HIPAA privacy and security rules. At the end, we'll, of course, break for questions, but if you have questions during, you can enter them into your chat box, and we will do our best to try to respond during the presentation to the things you want to make sure that we cover. So let's start with the HITECH Act and the breach notification requirements that it brought with it. And a little bit of history is before the HITECH Act was passed, there were only two states that had medical information within the definition of personal information that required notice when that information was breached. So there were 44 states that had breach notification statutes, but only two, Arkansas and California, had included medical information in their breach notification statutes. And as a result, if medical information was breached but personal financial information wasn't, that is, the payment information wasn't included, there was no obligation at the federal or state level to report that breach, and often breaches of medical information went unreported. To counteract that, the HITECH Act included the first federal breach notification requirement that applies to HIPAA-covered entities as well as business associates. Now, the statute was passed, and in addition to the statute, the Department of Health and Human Services is required to issue interim final regulations, which sounds odd, interim final, but these are regulations that will have the effect of final regulations until a further final regulation is passed, and they have to issue those 180 days after the statute was passed, which we calculate to be August 16, 2009. And those will become effective no later than 30 days after publication. So we are looking at being less than 1 month away from interim final regulations and less than 2 months away from a mandatory notification requirement for all breaches involving medical information. So we need to understand what that means. The breach of, and we're going to use the term unsecured PHI for now, and later we'll talk about what it means to have secured PHI, but if you have unsecured personal health information, that is information that somebody could see or view when it gets disclosed to an unauthorized person, the breach is considered to be any acquisition, access, use, or disclosure which would compromise the security or privacy of that information, except in a situation where the person to whom it was exposed would not likely or reasonably be able to retain the information. So what does that mean? We usually use that as the elevator over here exception. That is, if you mention some health information in a context where somebody is not likely to retain it, that's not considered a breach of this disclosure statute. It may be a breach of other provisions of HIPAA, but it's not a breach for purposes of the High Tech Act. What is a breach? Downloading information from a computer, a lost laptop, information on a disk, a hacker who breaks in and gets a copy of records, and even paper records that are acquired by an unauthorized person, because the breach of unsecured personal health information includes both electronic and hard copy information. That wasn't necessarily true about some of the state data breach notification statutes, but it's true about the federal one. So what happens when this information is breached? Well, HIPAA-covered entities and their business associates must provide notice without unreasonable delay to the people who are affected, and absolutely no later than 60 days after the breach is discovered. How is the notice supposed to be provided? Well, first-class mail, if the individual, in most cases, unless the individual has specified a preference for email, and there's a requirement that if more than 500 individuals in one state are affected, the entity must notify prominent media outlets in the state. So it's likely that if there's a significant compromise of data relating to patients, that you'll be in the unfortunate situation of not only having to inform the patients, but also having to tell the media, which, you know, results in, you know, placing a large kick me sign on you, both for press relation issues and for possible suits by class action plaintiffs. So this is a not a welcome provision in the notice requirement. You also must provide notice to the Department of Health and Human Services. And again, 500 becomes the magic number. If more than 500 people are affected, you have to notify them immediately. And if fewer than 500 people are affected, you have to keep an annual log and notify them at the end of the year. If you're a business associate, you must notify the covered entity of the breach so that they can fulfill their notice obligations. What goes into this notice that we have to provide? Well, you have to describe the breach and how it occurred, the type of information that was involved, whether it was medical record, diagnosis information, images, financial information, you know, not specific. You don't have to give every piece, but you do have to describe every category of information that was included. And you have to provide individuals information about how to protect themselves. And that information is generally available through the FTC website and through the state breach notification statutes. And, you know, we have lots of templates that are available to do that. But how to protect themselves usually involves, on the financial side, credit freeze information, and on the health insurance side, certainly watching for submission of unauthorized charges, et cetera. You also have to describe what you're doing to investigate the situation and to prevent future breaches, and you have to provide contact information for individuals to ask questions. Now, Health and Human Services published the information about the regulations that they had to be issued on August 16th and invited people to comment. And those comments were already due May 21st of this year, so there's no opportunity to comment now. But the questions that they asked people to comment on are somewhat instructive to figure out what their ultimate regulations are going to look like. First, they asked whether there were potential conflicts with state law or other issues that should be considered when coming up with the interim final final rules. And I put, for purpose of commentary, yes, Massachusetts law, for example, provides a clear conflict. Massachusetts state data breach notification law says that you may not describe information about the type of information that was disclosed and how the breach occurred. Their theory in Massachusetts was if you put information in the notice about the information that was taken, whoever's in possession of the information learns what they have and can use it and leverage it, and so your letters to people should be very plain and vanilla. The HHS rules, at least the statute, requires information about the breach, and so when the regulations come out, they're trying to balance what the federal statute requires and what may be required under state law. Similarly, they asked a question about whether entities would be required to provide multiple breach notices, one to satisfy federal law and one to satisfy state law, and again, Massachusetts is an example where that might occur. Third, they asked for comments on whether breach notification would still be required under state law if you took the steps that they suggested to secure information and make it not likely to be disclosed. And we're going to talk about securing information in a minute, but again, this is an area where we don't know exactly what the final regulation will look like, but they're worried about places where you don't have an obligation under one statute, but you do under another. So what do I keep saying when I say, what does the final rule look like? Well, we have a statute, but we now have an agency that's going to promulgate these detailed regulations as to all of those things I just mentioned, the content of the breach notice, how to provide notice, how fast to provide notice, et cetera. And the way to figure out pretty much exactly what the rule is going to look like is to look at what the FTC did. Because around the same time that the HHS issued this notice of rulemaking, the FTC issued their own proposed rule for non-HIPAA-covered entities who are vendors of personal health records. So again, going back to the framework I started with, state laws did not require notification when there had been a breach of medical information. The world's divided into two types of people who have medical information, those who are covered by HIPAA and those who are not. The FTC defined a category of people called vendors of personal health records that have access to personal health records but are not covered by HIPAA, and created rules for them to notify people. And I don't know how many of you on this call are non-HIPAA-covered entities who have personal health records, but if you are, this directly applies to you. And even if you're not, this is a good roadmap for what the HHS regulations will look like. So, again, there are some significant parallels to what we know is in the HITECH Act already. The FTC said if you're a vendor of personal health records, you have to notify every U.S. resident within 60 days of discovery of the breach, and you have to notify the FTC. Now, the FTC said you have to notify them within 5 business days if more than 500 people are involved, or at the end of 12 months on an annual log if there are fewer than 500. So when HHS comes out with its regulations and specifies the time period in which you have to notify them if more than 500 people are involved, you're likely to see a 5 business day requirement unless they took some of our comments and other people's comments to heart and provided us a somewhat longer notice period. You know, having done these things for 7 years, you know, in 5 days you don't necessarily know all the details you need to know about an incident in order to provide proper notice, but that's at least the initial way the FTC was leaning. The definitions in the FTC regulations are similar to what we looked at in HHS. Acquisition of information without authorization of the individual is a breach of security. And information that is deemed identifiable under the FTC rules is any information that will identify an individual or with respect to which there's a reasonable basis to believe that the information can be used to identify the individual. So this pertains to what you believe might be de-identified information that doesn't say it's Mark Zwillinger's, you know, scan, but it's a scan of a, you know, 39-year-old male who lives in Bethesda who had the following health conditions, et cetera, from which I might be able to be identified. And the FTC issued specific rules on that. So, again, these FTC rules are different from the HHS rules. They're more specific because the regulations were already issued, and they apply to non-HIPAA-covered entities who, for example, and I have, you know, several examples here on the slide, you know, provide, let's say, an Internet-based application that helps consumers manage their medications or provides a personal health checklist. It might be someone who offers, you know, access to personal health records that are portable or that are shared on a community basis. It could be that you have a record because you have individuals who are remotely being monitored through blood pressure cuffs or heart rate monitors and are tracking results through some sort of interactive application. Those would all be people who are subject to the FTC rules that have already been issued. Let's turn for a minute to the content of the notice, because, again, this is instructive as to what you'll likely see in the Health and Human Service regulations that come out in August. The notice requirements that the FTC set out are you have to describe how the breach occurred, including the specific date of the breach and when you discovered it. And, of course, the guidelines as to the 60-day rule and the 5-day rule, you know, depend on you having a specific date at which you discovered the breach. A description of the type of information involved in the breach, the steps individuals can take to protect themselves from harm, description of what you're doing to investigate the breach and mitigate losses, and a contact information, and they say specifically phone number, toll-free phone number, email address, or postal address. So these rules will be the guidepost to what the HHS rules will look like, and so there's no reason to wait till August 16th. Your view shouldn't be, I'll scramble and get a policy together after the final rules come out. We pretty much know exactly what those rules will look like now, and therefore people who are worried about compliance deadline of September can be productively working on this now. Some final key aspects of the FTC rulemaking, and then we'll switch back to HHS. The vendor has the obligation to demonstrate their compliance with the rule and providing notice. They can delay providing notice if there's an ongoing law enforcement investigation and law enforcement specifically requests it. In addition to the notice that's required by first-class mail or email if the individual has provided prior consent, they have a provision for substitute notice, like the must notify the media in every state if 500 or more residents are affected. It says if you can't reach 10 or more individuals directly, you must post on your website for 6 months the information related to the breach itself and all the information that needs to be contained in the notice. And again, that's not the kind of kick me sign you really want to hang on your website, at least not for a period of 6 months. It may be effective to put something up for a short period of time. We filed comments on behalf of entities saying the 6-month period was unreasonable and too long. We'll see if the FTC shortens it, but we can expect to see something similar in August from HHS. Finally, I just want to comment on what the FTC said with regard to unauthorized acquisition. Their definition is unauthorized acquisition will include any unauthorized access to unsecured health information unless the vendor can demonstrate that they have reliable evidence showing that there could not have been any unauthorized acquisition of such information. What does that mean? This seems like contradictory. There's an acquisition unless you can demonstrate there hasn't been an acquisition. Well, that might be a laptop theft scenario where a laptop is stolen and you think you might have to provide a breach, but then you recover the laptop so you can demonstrate that, you know, in those 5 days that the laptop was unavailable, no one accessed it. A forensic examination shows it wasn't accessed, or someone lost a device that had a PDA that had health information on it, but you were able to hit the kill switch. So in one case, there was a disclosure, but you were able to demonstrate there could not have been unauthorized acquisition because you deleted the data the second you discovered it. So you have the burden of showing that one of those situations applies to you. So I've said you don't need to wait to September, but that raises the question, so what should you do now? Well, the most important thing to do is identify the systems that you have that have covered data. And then, as we're going to talk about in a minute, determine whether you have an ability to secure that data so that it can never be the subject of the breach. Is it that data that you need? Do you have health information on patients that are no longer coming that you no longer need to maintain? Maybe you can destroy it if consistent with medical practices. If not, maybe you can encrypt it so that if it is disclosed or stolen or a tape gets lost, that it won't have been exposed. You certainly can start evaluating your privacy and security policies to determine if you have appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards to protect the information. Certainly, you're going to need to create and adopt an incident response plan for situations when there has been a breach. You need to figure out who internally will be responsible for running that plan and making sure that you're prepared to deal with the breach, and who are your external vendors, PR, consultants, forensic advisors, lawyers, who are you going to turn to, especially if there's a 5-day period in which you have to provide a notice in writing to Health and Human Services like you would to the FTC? You've got to be really quick, because whatever you provide in writing isn't going to be privileged. It's going to be out there. It's going to get exposed on the Internet one day or another. It's going to be used in litigation against you, so you've got to get it right, and you've got to get it right quickly. And of course, and I'm not just saying this because it's related to the subject of the webinar, these are losses that you need to figure out how to insure against, and incident response insurance policies are one way to reduce the risk in addition to going through steps to produce to protect the data. So let me turn it over to Rebecca for a second to talk about how all of these security breach notification statutes and the regulations, the HHS and FTC, how does that interact with HIPAA and what HIPAA says already under the privacy and security rule?
Thanks, Mark. As Mark mentioned a minute ago, prior to the HITECH Act, there really was no breach notification requirement under HIPAA. But what we do see is that once HHS OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, who's the agency tasked with enforcing the privacy rule, or CMS, who's tasked with enforcing the security rule, finds out about these breaches one way or another, they do tend to issue a letter, an inquiry letter, or something coming back to say, show us why we should not further investigate the situation or issue or impose penalties upon the organization. So what the HIPAA privacy rule does require is it requires, in response to a breach, a number of steps that you have to take, or not even a breach, but any impermissible use or disclosure of PHI. You actually have to mitigate any harmful effect of the unauthorized disclosure. So in terms of a security breach, this may be filing a police report, notifying the individuals to place them on notice to protect themselves. You also have to go through and sanction any employee who failed to comply with either the privacy and security rule or any of your internal policies and procedures. You also, interestingly enough, while you didn't have to notify individuals, you did have to account for any disclosure of PHI that was not authorized. In addition, you also want to go through and evaluate whether or not you think people, your employees, need to train or be retrained, and then evaluate your policies and procedures. And the reason why these steps are necessary is not only because they're currently and will be on a going forward basis HIPAA requirements, but because when you are issuing that letter back to CMS or to OCR, you want to have each of these sort of hot-button issues addressed in that letter. We see that their major concern, the government's major concern, is do you have a compliance program in place that will prevent future instances of this occurring? And so we just look to see these five bullet points here are extraordinarily important and in response to a breach. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Mark just to go over avoiding the HITECH Act's breach notification requirements, because Mark foreshadowed a minute ago, if you secure your PHI, you can avoid these requirements altogether.
Thanks, Rebecca. So as I indicated, the breach notification requirement applies to the breach of unsecured PHI. And so the HITECH Act required Health and Human Services to issue guidance specifying what specific technology or methodology would render PHI secure. And secure, is as defined by the HITECH Act, is unusable, unreadable, or indecipherable to the unauthorized individual who gains access to it. If you have rendered your PHI unusable, unreadable, or indecipherable, it is secure. So if you have a breach of secure PHI, it is not subject to the breach notification requirement. So the question is, how do we do that? How do we secure our PHI? Well, helpfully, Health and Human Services complied with the HITECH Act requirement on an April 17th, issued what they considered an exhaustive list. And that's underlined because by saying this, then these are the only ways under the statute for now, until further guidance comes out, that you can render PHI secure. And there's two ways: encrypt it or destroy it. If it's not encrypted or destroyed when it is accessed, and obviously destroyed when it is accessed is a little bit of contradiction. It wasn't accessed, it was destroyed. But if the data isn't encrypted or destroyed, it's not secure. With regard to encryption, electronic personal health information must be encrypted by an algorithmic process that transforms data into a form where there's what they say a low probability of assigning a meaning without the confidential key, the security key that's needed to decrypt the data, as long as that confidential process or security key has not been breached. So if I encrypt the data with a passphrase, and then I write the passphrase down and stick it in a piece of paper in the laptop, and the encrypted laptop is taken, I don't qualify because it was encrypted, but the confidential key that's necessary to decrypt it was breached with the laptop. So, you know, I know many of you on the phone are well aware of people in your organization who will write a password down and put it on a post-it and stick it on their computer. That won't do the trick if you're using encryption. That cannot be written down and kept with the computer itself. So what did HHS say for encryption? They said, well, you've got to follow the encryption processes that are issued under the NIST publication for the Guide to Storage Encryption Technologies for Devices. And including but not limited to full disk encryption, volume encryption, virtual disk encryption, or file and folder encryption. And that NIST guidelines refers to further FIPS standards, and if I go into further detail about the types of algorithms that are included, a lot of you on this call will immediately drop off, and instead of having 28 logged-in participants, we'll have 15. So I'm not going to go into too much geek detail, but I will say that there are various algorithmic standards for encrypting data, and these samples on these slides, advanced encryption, triple DES, skipjack algorithms, are known to be secure algorithms that if you encrypt your data using these algorithms, you should be able to argue that the data is secure because you're in compliance with the NIST requirement and the FIPS standard. But it's not a simple checklist. That is, if you said to me, Mark, help me figure out how to encrypt my data so that it'll never be unsecure and I'll never have to worry about this breach, which method should I use? Should I use full disk encryption or file encryption? The answer is it depends, because the standard depends on the risk you're trying to insure against. For example, let's say I have full disk encryption on all laptops in the organization. Great idea. Laptop is stolen, and on all desktops and everything. Laptop is stolen, desktop is stolen, hard drive is taken. Full disk encryption, nobody can get access to the data. But that doesn't secure the data against people within the organization who have access to that laptop. So if I have a medical organization, I've 10 people who share a laptop, and I want to make sure that one of those users doesn't look at files on the laptop they're not supposed to look at, the only technical way to do that is to have file or folder encryption, where each folder is encrypted with a password, and you can only access that folder if you know the password for that folder. So the whole disk encryption would be a FIPS-approved method of insuring against loss vis-a-vis a third party, but it wouldn't be a way against insider loss. And that's my example of why the FIPS standard isn't a checklist we can just go through easily, but with some focus on it, we can apply it and figure out how to make sure you're in compliance with the secure PHI requirement. So that's encryption. Let's talk for a minute about destruction. In order to be destroyed for purposes of the secure guidance, you have to destroy it in a secure manner. That doesn't mean breaking the CD and throwing it in the trash. So hard copy media, such as paper and film, because remember that this applies to electronic and paper-based records, must be shredded or destroyed in a way so you cannot reconstruct the PHI. Electronic media must be cleared, purged, or destroyed consistent with the NIST guidelines for media sanitization, which usually involves overwriting the data, demagnetizing the data, burning the data, getting rid of it in a way that the guidance has provided for you that will make the data secure, so you're not in a situation where you've gotten rid of and sort of reformatted a hard drive, gone to sell it on eBay, someone buys it and gets access to a bunch of medical records. That's a bad scenario. That's a breach. It may be a violation of the privacy and security rules. It will require breach notification. It wouldn't be secured. So we've got to make sure we have put into place, again, good thing to do before the September deadline, policies and procedures for secure destruction of data. Do you have to encrypt data? No. Is it a good time to reevaluate whether you should encrypt data, whether it's worth the investment? Well, the cost of encryption is likely less expensive than the cost of addressing the security breach, because if a security breach happens, you have the PR aspects, you have the internal distraction, you have your outside costs for attorneys, and your outside costs for, possibly a third-party forensic consultant to figure out what happened with the breach, and then you've got to put up the cost of providing the notice, and if it's, 100,000 people you have to provide notice to, just the postage alone is an expensive event, and then you have to have a toll-free line for people to call and the call center, and, while you don't have to necessarily under the statute build a call center, if you don't, then you have internal costs as well. So, you have to rethink, and under the statute, what are the costs I'm likely to incur by having a breach of unsecured PHI, and how could I insure against that, either through insurance or through internal policies and procedures to reduce the risk. Of course, no longer retaining medical records longer than necessary is a good way to reduce the exposure you have to a breach. So with that, that wraps my part of the discussion on breach notification and security, and I'm going to turn it back to Rebecca, who's been working for years with HIPAA privacy and security and other HIPAA rules, to talk about, aside from breach notification, how have the privacy and security rules changed. Rebecca?
Great. Thanks, Mark. In addition to the breach notification provisions, there are four things that the HITECH Act did to change HIPAA privacy and security, or at least the four most major. It actually expanded the applicability of HIPAA in some ways to business associates, and we'll talk about that. It also limited certain uses and disclosures of PHI. It increased individuals' rights with respect to their PHI, and it also increased penalties and enforcement under HIPAA privacy and security. So we'll go through each of those one by one. The first one is the applicability to business associates, and there's been quite a bit of talk about this in the industry. Prior to the HITECH Act, under the HIPAA privacy rule, business associates were not directly subject to HIPAA privacy or security. Rather, the privacy and the security rules required that covered entities obtain reasonable assurances from their business associates that the business associate would protect the privacy and security of the PHI. And that always takes the form of a business associate agreement. The interesting thing is that any time there was a breach, so if a business associate actually violates that, the only liability to ensue is the breach of contract claim. So what we saw was there was very little, I don't say very little, but there's somewhat more of a lax approach by covered entities, by business associates, to implement rigorous privacy and security policies and procedures, et cetera, because the liability was not very much. What the HITECH Act did was it expanded the reach of the HIPAA privacy and security rules. One thing that's extremely important to keep in mind is this particular provision of the HITECH Act is not effective until February 16th of 2010. So in terms of the HIPAA security rule, under the HITECH Act, BAs must now comply directly with the HIPAA security rule. So what this means is you are actually implementing everything you would have to implement if you were a covered entity. So that includes conducting a security risk assessment and then implementing administrative, physical, and technical safeguards that are outlined in the security rule. And we don't have much time to go through those in detail, but they are set forth in significant detail in the security rule. Some are required, some are addressable. And that's, you know, a whole separate webinar on that issue. You also have to have in place policies and procedures to protect the security of PHI. Interestingly, the HITECH Act took a very different approach with the HIPAA privacy rule. It's important to know that BAs still are not required to comply directly with the HIPAA privacy rule. Instead, BAs are continued to provide reasonable assurances in the form of a BA agreement. What the HITECH Act said is if you BA actually violate the terms of your BA agreement, then you can be subject to the same civil and criminal penalties that would be imposed upon you if you were a covered entity and had violated the privacy or security rule. So it's sort of a roundabout way to get you to comply with the privacy rule, but it does allow some leeway in that it doesn't impose a lot of the administrative requirements that covered entities have to comply with. The practical effect of this is that business associate agreements are going to need to be revised to incorporate these new HITECH Act requirements. Some of these, the most important ones, are the breach notification obligations that Mark spoke about a few minutes ago. There's a lot of angst in the industry about when does this have to take place and how are we going to get covered in business associates rather to agree to this. It's interesting because most of your BA agreements currently have in place provisions that relate to this. Breach notification obligation, for example, you must have a provision in your BA agreement that says to the extent there's an impermissible disclosure of PHI, you have to notify the covered entity. So that really is, in a way, already in your agreement. Compliance with the security rule, your current provision that has to be in there says you have to implement administrative, physical, and technical safeguards. Now, most BA agreements don't currently go into great detail about what that means, and covered entities imposing that upon their BAs really didn't make any of the BAs certify compliance with this, but folks are definitely taking a second look and saying, well, what did that provision mean in the first place? And now you'll see that it means compliance with the security rule. New penalties for breaches, and then changes to individual rights that we'll talk about in a minute. Interestingly enough, with respect to changes to individual rights, you already have these provisions in your BA agreements. You have to require your business associate to account for disclosures, and we'll talk about that. The biggest change the HITECH Act made. So you'll see that while it seems like there's a lot of changes in the HITECH Act, many of the provisions that the HITECH Act requires are already in your existing agreements. They just need to be tweaked depending on how they're written. So what I talked about, the second thing the HITECH Act did was it placed additional limitations on the use and disclosure of PHI. One of the biggest ones is marketing. Marketing has been a sore spot for privacy since the privacy rule, back in even before 2001 even. For those of you who have followed the history of the privacy rule, marketing has been changed several times, whether it's the definition of marketing or the marketing exclusion under the privacy rule. And not surprisingly, Congress decided when they're going to enact the High Tech Act, they're going to further restrict the ways in which you can use and disclose PHI for marketing. So if you remember, in the privacy rule currently, there's an exclusion from the marketing definition that says if certain communications are made, they will not be considered marketing and thus don't need an authorization prior to their use or disclosure. And those really relate to things that fall into the bucket of treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, if you can look at the definition 1, 2, and 3 below. So if you're talking about describing a health-related product or service, or if you're a health plan and you're talking about what's included in your plan, or if you're a provider and you're saying, well, we offer X, Y, and Z service here, that's not marketing under HIPAA. Well, what the High Tech Act did was it said, okay, we get that. It's not marketing. But to the extent that you start receiving payments for that, you know, maybe it is marketing. So they said, well, we're going to say it is marketing if you receive payment, unless. So they have an exception, and they created a rule, and they created another exception. So it just creates, you know, more confusion in the marketing realm. The reality is if you make any communications for, you know, health-related product or service and someone's paying you, so let's say you start talking about a particular drug and you're getting payment from a pharma company, government has said, you know, that is marketing, unless the communication describes a drug or biologic currently being prescribed. So if the person's already on that drug and you're talking to them about it, not marketing, not an issue. If the communication is made by a covered entity and has already received a HIPAA authorization, that exception doesn't really make much sense to me and probably to none of you in the audience as well, because if you went out and you got a HIPAA authorization already, you don't really care if it's considered marketing or not, because you've already done what you'd have to do if it was considered marketing. So I sort of kind of blow that one off a little bit. The third one is a little bit confusing in the way it was written in the High Tech Act. And what we believe it to mean is that if you were engaging a business associate to make a communication on your behalf, the fact that you're paying that business associate to make the communication, that doesn't make it marketing. If it really is about treatment or care coordination or case management and being done by your third party agent, you're paying them just to help you with that, that's not going to be marketing either. So we move on to the second limitation on disclosure, and that's fundraising. Another hot-button issue for the government, they've sort of taken gun back and forth on this. The change the High Tech Act made is currently all you have to do in order to use or disclose for fundraising is that you have to put a note, you have to put a statement in your notice of privacy practices that says we may use or disclose for fundraising. Now you actually have to have in that fundraising communication information how the recipient can actually opt out of any of these communications. Significantly, anyone that opts out of those communications, they've considered that to be a revocation of authorization. So if you do receive this opt-out, you can't sort of just put it in the drawer and say, all right, yeah, we'll make a point, try not to fundraise to this person. It is treated as an impermissible use or disclosure of PHI on a go-forward basis and a violation of the privacy rule if you actually use it for those purposes. One of the biggest landmines for the privacy rule has always been minimum necessary and probably the most difficult to implement of all of the requirements. The privacy rule basically requires you to disclose only the minimum amount of PHI necessary to accomplish a permitted user disclosure. Well, that has been very difficult to comply with. People just really don't understand what it means. So the High Tech Act required HHS to issue guidance on the minimum necessary standard by around this time next year. And the interesting thing is the High Tech Act says, well, until HHS issues this guidance, here's what we're going to say is minimum necessary, compliance with that standard. User disclose a limited data set, which is basically, for all intents and purposes, almost de-identified information. And then they say, to the extent practicable. Well, it's really kind of a wishy-washy standard because there's a lot of instances where you may or may not be able to use that, the limited data set. So they say, well, or if it's necessary, use the minimum necessary. So then you say, well, how does that help me? What is the minimum necessary? It sort of defines itself by using its own term. So personally, it looks like it's just as difficult to implement now as it was prior to the High Tech Act, and hopefully next year HHS will come up with something a little bit more clear. Significantly, in terms of what was proposed by the House and Senate, which did not make its way into the High Tech Act, which I probably received more calls on this in, you know, the few weeks before the High Tech Act was passed than I could ever imagine, was the question was HHS was going to be given the power or the mandate to go through the definition of healthcare operations and exclude from that definition those types of disclosures that you could either make with an authorization or de-identified. Well, this caused so much angst in the healthcare industry, as you can imagine, because your healthcare operations disclosures are what you do on a day-to-day basis to run your business. Significantly, it was not included in the HITECH Act. So the HITECH Act does not require the secretary to review and modify the definition. The third thing the HITECH Act did was it increased individuals' rights with respect to their PHI. The biggest one I know people are talking about now is the accounting for disclosures. Currently, you don't have to account for disclosures of PHI for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations purposes for TPO disclosures. And that's great because TPO is what you do most often throughout the day. The HITECH Act eliminates that exception for disclosures made of an electronic health record. Now, while the reality is you're going to have to disclose TPOs or account for TPO disclosures of your EHRs, the reality is the compliance date is pretty far off. If you had electronic health records in place prior to January 1, 2009, that compliance date's not till January 1, 2014, which has certainly made a lot of folks I've spoken with a sigh of relief. If you acquire an EHR after January 1, 2009, or currently, or any date thereafter, your compliance date is January 1, 2011. Still pretty far off. The other leeway that the government gave is that instead of having to report back or account for disclosures 6 years back, it's only a 3-year reporting requirement, so a little bit less. Second, the restrictions on disclosures. I used to like to call this the right without any enforcement, because what it used to say is that if you're an individual, you have the right to restrict the ways in which a covered entity uses or discloses your PHI for true and payment health care operations purposes, but you had no obligation to do so. Well, interestingly enough, HITECH Act came back and said, okay, well, in this instance, you generally don't have a corresponding obligation to do so, but to the extent that the individual requests that you don't disclose PHI to a health plan for payment or healthcare operations purposes, and that person has paid for the cost of care out of pocket in full, you have to agree to that request. And it makes sense. So if you pay for something out of pocket and you don't want it to make its way back to your insurance company, it doesn't need to. So that's really where it goes. Extremely important, increased enforcement and penalties. As I mentioned earlier, HHS OCR enforces privacy rule and HHS CMS enforces the security rule. They'll continue to do so, but the HITECH Act requires HHS to formally investigate certain complaints if a preliminary investigation indicates a possible violation due to willful neglect. And you'll see willful neglect also plays a part into the revised CMPs that can be issued for violations. Privacy rule, security rule still don't have a private right of action, but what the HITECH Act did do is it sort of met in the middle, and it said, well, we won't give you a private right of action, individuals, but now we're going to let state attorneys generals come in to bring civil actions in federal court on behalf of its residents if it believes that interest of one or more, which I think is pretty significant, has been threatened or adversely affected by a HIPAA violation. Now, we haven't seen that happen yet, or I haven't seen it happen yet, but I would anticipate that state attorneys general are going to really love that sort of power. And as you see the breach notifications come out, I'm sure you're going to see more enforcement at that end. In addition to increased enforcement, we saw increased penalties. One of the pieces that's not on the slide, which is significant to healthcare providers, is that if you remember the Richard Gibson case, I believe it was back in 2005, there was some question about Richard Gibson was an employee of a healthcare provider. He himself was not a covered entity. He was not a doctor. He was no one that would be covered directly, but he was an employee. And he was prosecuted, the first one prosecuted under the HIPAA privacy rule for violating HIPAA because he, I believe, sold or utilized the credit card information of cancer patients and racked up enormous credit card bills. And so he was prosecuted, and there was some academic debate back and forth about whether or not he could have, in quotes, violated this part, which is which is part of the penalties for HIPAA. DOJ came back and said, no, you can't prosecute. HITECH Act came back and said, individuals, absolutely, who are not covered entities, but who are employees, for example, of a healthcare provider who's a covered entity, absolutely can be prosecuted criminally for violations of HIPAA. So your employees really need to know that, because to the extent they do something that violates HIPAA in their role as an employee for you, they're subject to criminal penalties. On the civil side, the HITECH Act created a tiered approach to civil monetary penalties. Number one, I won't go through the slide in great detail. There's a lot of text here, but it gives you a summary of what the penalties are now. Importantly, it did increase the amounts per violation, also increased the maximum amount of penalties, and it sort of created different states of mind throughout each of these bullet points. And very importantly, while a lot of the provisions of the High-Tech Act don't go into effect until February 2010 or certain months hereafter, these are in effect now. So if you're found to violate privacy or security rules now, this is what you'll be facing, these kind of CMPs. I'm actually looking at a question here, and someone's asking, is the February 16th date a recent development? The person asks, our understanding is that the business associate applicability provision is in effect now. It's a February 17th, 2009. And actually, if you look at the High-Tech Act, unless the provision of that particular provision has a compliance date, which the BA provision does not. If you go over, and I don't know if the section off the top of my head, but if you go over maybe about another page or page and a half, or, you know, 5 or 10 provisions later, it says, generally speaking, unless otherwise stated in this rule, the compliance date for all High-Tech Act provisions in the privacy section is 1 year after the effective date, which is going to be 2010. So that is the case for BAs. It's in the High-Tech Act 1 year later. So with that, actually, those are the end of our prepared remarks. I'm going to turn it back over to Tom, so that maybe we can open it up to some questions and answers. We can help you all understand some of the nuances.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca, very much. That concludes our presentations. Now we invite everyone listening to ask questions or to comment on what we've discussed. Julie, would you please conduct our participants on how to register a question?
If you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, star 1 for any audio questions or comments at this time. Your first question comes from the line of David Carmody.
Yes, my question, this is Kathy Cascrande with David. My question is regarding the logging. If that is a requirement of only if you've hit the 500 plus club, is there any requirement for any logging for a security breach under 500? So to me, in the rule, it was a little bit unclear.
So I think there's two parts to the question that Rebecca and I will address in turn. The first is the logging for a breach that you're required to provide to either FTC or HHS, depending on which entity you are. And the second is the accounting rule that you need to, with regard to keeping records for an individual patient's file. I'll start with the disclosure rule. You either have to disclose immediately to HHS or FTC, depending on which you are, or create a log of security events for fewer than 500, keep it in your file, and at the end of the year, turn over your log. That's the breach notification disclosure provision.
And then the second piece of that, while you have to create a security breach log, if you have an unauthorized use, a disclosure of PHI, you then have to account for that for the individual. So if the individual comes back and says, tell me all the ways in which you used or disclosed my PHI in the last, you know, 4 years, you're required to provide that inappropriate user disclosure to that person. So it's sort of an indirect breach notification to the individual.
Once the breach notification laws go into effect, even if you have fewer than 500 people, you do always have to tell the affected individual without unreasonable delay with no later than 60 days. So the rules kind of merge going forward. You have to tell them and you have to put a note in their file. But if they make a request, you actually have to go back 4 years, even 2 years ago when there was no breach notification rule. If you had a disclosure, you were supposed to have accounted for that and put it in the file. So they'll get 4 years back worth of data on a request. But only going forward will they get a notice of a future breach.
Or let me take a step back. The 4 years was an example for 6 years back under the rule in case that is important to you.
Right, because that would be the original HIPAA thing. Yeah, that's what it was unclear is whether it was, if it's 500, you're turning in the log to HHS immediately. If it's under 500, if that's correct, then you are just noting that internally and creating a log of breaches.
Which you'd then turn in at the end of the year, right?
Correct, which we would have to return. We would have to turn into HHS so they can report to Congress on a yearly basis, I guess is the intent.
Exactly.
Great. Thank you so much.
And just to repeat the disclaimer that just went up on the slide before, while that's our best answer to the question, of course, that's not legal advice, and we are not your lawyers, as far as I know, since I don't know who you are at this point, so we're not your lawyers, but that's our best answer.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. And I'm showing there are no further questions.
Okay, we'll give it another second or two. Anybody else?
Again, star one at this time for any questions or comments.
Well, Julie, I'm going to assume that silence is telling that there's no other questions. So if that's the case, that brings us to the end of our time today. We'd like to thank everyone on the line for participating. And as mentioned earlier, this is going to be a recorded session. We will push this link out to you all via email. I encourage you to share it with other members within your staff or organization. Remember to check your email tomorrow for instructions on how to access the materials and the recording of this presentation. I thank you all very much for your participation and wish you a great afternoon. Goodbye.